This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 125, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And if you want to hear the extended version of this interview, please join the Patreon campaign. You can now get a 7-day free trial where you can access more than 100 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Robert Powell about his book, UFOs: A Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know. Robert Powell was the Director of Research at the Mutual UFO Network from 2007 to 2017, and also founded MUFON's Science Review Board. Currently, he is on the board of the Scientific Coalition for the Study of UAPs. He is also a member of the Society for Scientific Exploration, the UFO Data Project, and the National Space Society. Hi, Robert. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Well, hi, Simon. Thank you for inviting me.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called UFOs: A Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know. You say in the book that you were at the MUFON for, was it 16, 17 years? Is that right?
From the year 2006 until 2017, so 11 years.
And that was working full time, wasn't it? Because is it that you retired and then you kind of did that?
Right. I retired, actually. I retired early. I was in the semiconductor industry, and I retired in 2006. And so I would say on average, I've probably averaged 20 hours per week on the subject of UFOs.
For those 16, 17 years?
Right.
And you were their director of research?
Yes. About 6 months after I started at MUFON, I became their director of research. So I was responsible basically for looking at how cases were analyzed and looking for the best cases that were coming in to MUFON.
And did you feel they were doing a good job before you got there?
Before I got there, I would say that, you know, that there was a lot of improvement that could be done. And I made improvements while I was there. But the main difference is I wanted more of a scientific approach to the subject. And MUFON is a larger organization, and there's politics involved, and there's also the need to make funding, right, to keep the organization running. So that causes them to move towards whatever group will come to their conference, for example.
So you said that you wanted to be more scientific, but I suppose the big problem with UFOs is it's not like you can get one and put it in a lab and do science experiments. So how can you make it scientific studying this?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And I talk about that in the book. In science, we have what we'll call the hard sciences and the soft sciences, right? And the soft sciences are things such as psychology and sociology. And the hard sciences are like chemistry and physics. And in the hard sciences, you can repeat an experiment, right? You have control of your experiment. And if you tell someone else how to run that experiment, if they duplicate it properly, they can get the same results as you. In the soft sciences, that's a little more difficult, right? Because if you're dealing with, let's say, a pack of animals and you're trying to see how they react, they may or may not react in the same manner to a given set of stimuli. And the reason for that is because intelligence is involved, and the different animals in a pack may make different decisions than another pack, right? And if you move up to like human beings, that problem is magnified further. That's why, you know, psychology is a soft science, and it's not something that every person reacts the same way. So if you make the assumption that we're dealing with an intelligence when we're dealing with UFOs, then you have to realize that not only do you have the same problems, right, that you have in the soft sciences, but furthermore, if you're dealing with an intelligence that's more advanced than you, then you have to take into consideration that you may not even be the one running the experiment. So that's one thing I try to get across in the book, is that you can't expect to get a repeat on an experiment that you run, right? So you have to approach it. You can still approach it in scientific method, but you can't expect that, for example, if I saw, and let's just say I recorded with instrumentation, a disc-shaped object 30 feet across that was the color blue, and it moved in a certain manner, right? Well, I will probably never repeat that experiment and get that same object and get some of those same parameters that I measured the first time. It's just not going to happen. So that doesn't mean that we still can't collect data and try to understand it and make the best, you know, hypotheses that we can. But I think it's important that scientists realize that when you're dealing with UFOs, it's really like you're dealing with a very soft science.
And I saw NASA did a press conference recently in the last few months, and they are studying UFOs, and I think they did a press conference to talk about how they're bringing science to it. But I got the impression that they're being, I don't know what it is, it's like they've got their paradigm and they're stuck in it, and it's, they're not looking outside the box, so to speak, and they won't accept stuff that could actually be quite interesting.
Right. So I've communicated with the gentleman who headed up the NASA project, Dan Evans, a very nice guy. And what most people don't always understand is NASA really was not investigating UFOs per se. What they were doing is, that team's job was to look at equipment that NASA has today, right? Satellites that are in orbit, et cetera, and try to make a determination if whether or not any of that equipment might have some data related to UFOs. And when they were finished with the project, the NASA equipment is not set up for that. Military satellite systems are, but NASA satellite systems are set up to look, for example, at giant swaths of the Earth, such as, you know, is there global warming, or, you know, what is the distance between the satellite to the ocean surface, and are the oceans rising or falling? That type of satellite information is not the type that you need to, you know, try to examine UFOs. So NASA really was not trying to resolve the UFO problem itself. They were just looking to see if they had equipment that might be able to aid in the study of UFOs. And the answer, of course, was they didn't.
You say in the book as well, I think, that there's military equipment, whether it's radar or satellites, that might be able to pick up UFOs. But their software is set up to filter out anything that they're not really looking for, which is, say, enemies launching intercontinental ballistic missiles or bombers coming over.
Right. So here, Simon, you're asking specifically about our satellite systems, right? And our satellite systems are looking for specific patterns, like an ICBM missile, and the way it comes up, and they're looking for particular speed ranges and sizes. And there is so much data that those satellites and any satellite-based radar systems detect. And the reason is because we have an enormous amount of space debris in orbit around the planet. And so they have to filter all this junk out so that they can look for specific types of patterns. And the type of pattern that we have seen from UFOs, such as extreme accelerations, right, and the ability to suddenly stop, is not something they're looking for, right? Because objects don't just stop in space that are orbiting the Earth. They're in a particular moving pattern. So that is the reason I believe that we probably have not detected objects from our satellite-based systems. But we have detected objects from ground-based radar systems by the military. The 2004 incident with the USS Nimitz is one of several examples.
Yeah, and I talked to a guest on the podcast who was on a aircraft carrier during the Vietnam War, and he said they would pick up these things. I think they called them fast walkers or something. And it was almost a routine. And he'd say to his officer, look, I've picked up another one of these. And they'd just say, okay, just log it and then get on with your day.
Yeah, and yeah, that's interesting you say that. I've talked to several military guys, and they say the same thing. And as a matter of fact, one guy, they had an extensive situation where this object was following their destroyer for an extended period of time. And finally, the object left. And so he asked the captain, should I go ahead and log that in? And the captain told him, no, don't put it in the logs. I want to make admiral someday. So he felt it would not be a good thing to be in his logbook. So he just said, don't put it in there.
Doing a scientific study of UFOs, like we said, you can't just do a repeated experiments with them, but also they behave in waves that seem to be so beyond our technology. It's almost, you know, that thing where technology is so advanced, it seems like magic. And so where do you even start analyzing that kind of behavior?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, Simon. It's the objects, you know, rapid movement and then suddenly stopping and not interacting with the atmosphere. That's something that we cannot easily duplicate. It doesn't mean it violates physics necessarily, but it's clearly something that we don't know how to do. In the book, I calculate some of the G-forces, right, that an object moving that speed, the amount of G-forces it would generate on anyone within such a vehicle. And when I say G-forces, just so the audience knows, like one G-force is what we feel right now as we sit in our chair. Let's say you weigh 160 pounds, at two G-forces, you feel the weight of twice your weight. So 320 pounds as you sit in a chair. Now, when you get up to six G-forces, you will pass out within a few seconds. And at 13 G-forces, for example, most aircraft, the wings will be ripped off of the jet. So the G-forces we calculate from radar data on some of the UFOs have been in hundreds of G-forces. And it's almost like nonsensical. It doesn't even make any sense as to how an object could move that fast at that speed. And during the whole process, it doesn't actually heat the atmosphere or create a sonic boom. Like a meteorite, when it moves into our atmosphere and it's moving at 50,000 miles an hour, it burns up very high up where the air is very thin. Yet these objects are moving at those kind of speeds in the lower atmosphere and not even glowing, you know, red hot or anything. So it's a real conundrum as to how that's done. One possibility that I've kicked around is if they have the ability to lower their mass to basically zero. So if you can imagine if you had no weight, but you still were there, right? If you had zero mass, then a light beam that would shine on you would push you, right? And it would rapidly push you to the speed of light. So it's almost as if somehow they are able to drive their what we call inertial mass towards zero to do what they're doing. But we have no way of knowing how to do that. We don't even know actually if it's possible.
I talked to several people who've had all sorts of experiences on this podcast. And there was one guy, which is kind of linked to something else you talk about in the book, which is this thing with time going missing. And he was standing in this space and there was this disc there just a few feet off the ground, not too far away. And he said the thing about it is that it looked really odd. And he described it as kind of like it was phased out of our reality, which I suppose he means some, you know, interdimensional or multi-universe or something. If they were capable of doing that, I suppose they could move real fast in our atmosphere.
Yeah, what that gentleman described to you, I've heard many times, where the object, it's there, it as far as they can tell, it's a physical object, but something seems odd. One example, there were two brothers who were fishing, and they were near a Navy post where, you know, it's just basically a post where Navy divers go to it. And these two large disc-shaped objects came flying rapidly and stopped right near the Navy platform. And he said they were hovering, but he said, but it's not like they were really hovering. He said it's almost like they were just, you know, transfixed and sitting there. You know, not like, you know, when you're hovering, you're normally moving just slightly because there's air that pushes you this way or that way, or you're adjusting. But he said these objects were, it's almost like you painted them into the sky.
Yeah, it's weird because I heard somebody else describe an object that they said it was very close to their bedroom window and it was big and it was rotating. But he was saying the way it rotated seemed so perfect. It couldn't be real. It was just, you never see stuff move like that.
It's unfortunate we've never been able to capture something like that on camera. But it really requires an object to be in your sight for close to a minute to be able to react properly and to film an object. Because most people, right, you're not prepared because it happens at a point in time that you were not expecting it. So the first thing that happens to a person is there's this moment of kind of shock and a moment where your brain is trying to decide, am I really seeing what I'm seeing or am I going crazy or what? What's going on here? And then by the time you finally, realize, okay, I think it's really there. It's not me going crazy. And you decide you're going to take a picture of the object. By then, 10 seconds has gone by. And unless the object hangs around for an extended period of time, you won't have that opportunity to take a picture. There's only been a handful of photographs of objects, you know, at a reasonable distance where you can make it out clearly. But even those, you know, there's always the debates, right? Okay, maybe they faked it. Maybe they did this to make it look like it was a UFO, right? And the other thing is a picture can't capture also that feeling that you have when you look at something and it's like, well, it's not really hovering. It's almost like you just planted it into the sky, right? You can't really capture that in a photograph.
You know, you mentioned in the book that there are, seems to be times, I think this is getting less scientific as we go along, that there seem to be times when a witness kind of felt they just knew to look in a certain direction and to see the UFO, almost like the occupants of the UFO were telepathically telling him or giving him something to look that way. The occupants were showing the UFO to him on purpose. They wanted to be seen.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I I guess over my career, I have personally interviewed hundreds of individuals and I've read thousands of reports. And what you are describing is not unusual at all. I mean, it doesn't happen all the time, but it's not unusual. And it makes you wonder, right? As the investigator, it's like, what I always wonder is, okay, were they really kind of something made them decide, hey, there's something behind me? You don't know. Is that a coincidence or is that real? But I've heard so many times it makes you wonder that perhaps it's real. And the one case that really came to my mind was a husband and wife. The wife was a math teacher and the husband was a forest ranger. And every morning they have this same routine. They come out at 5 a.m. He has his coffee. He kisses her and she kisses him goodbye. He leaves and goes to work. And often they would look at the stars, right? They enjoyed astronomy. And so he was familiar, for example, with the constellation Orion. And for one day, they go out, they're doing their usual thing, and he looks up at Orion, and he sees this small UFO that's moving around. I believe it was either the star Rigel or the star Betelgeuse, one of the two stars in Orion. And something tells him to look up. So he looks up and he sees it. And then he sees the star brightening as if it was a nova, right? But the star, he knows it can't brighten. It's not what's called a variable star. And then the UFO just moves around the star. So it was almost as if it was saying, I'm demonstrating something for you that you should be observing and paying attention to, right? I don't know what it's trying to say, but it almost seems like some type of communication. So the example your friend told you is that happens a lot.
And I'm wondering if they can communicate that they're there and they wanted you to see them, they could also switch off something that makes you feel you need to take a picture.
I've heard people say that. I've heard people say, you know, I was watching this object and I don't know why I didn't reach down to my camera and take a photograph, right? Sometimes that potentially could happen, but there are photographs of UFOs, some famous ones. But it doesn't happen very often. I'm talking about a good photograph, fairly close up, not, you know, a light in the sky or an object that's moving far away. One example of this, what I'll call, you know, strange communication, happened in the 2004 incident with the USS Nimitz and the F-18s. And so maybe I'll just give a little background to the audience so that they know what happens. There's a USS Navy task force is out in the Southwest Pacific off the coast of California. And the radar operators noticed these objects that are at high altitude, and they've been noticing them for several days, but they're not interfering with the strike group. And when I say a strike group, that is an aircraft carrier, a cruiser, two destroyers, an attack submarine, and multiple other support craft. It's a strike group that the U.S. sends, for example, to the Middle East. When you hear the USS Nimitz or the USS Eisenhower, you know, has gone to the Middle East, that strike group is a whole fleet of ships. So back to the story, the strike group that was practicing to go to the Middle East was off the coast of California. And they kept seeing these objects at 80,000 plus feet. And then one day they're getting ready to do what they call a red-blue exercise. That's where a group of jets on the aircraft carrier are going to defend the strike group from a group of jets that will take off from the mainland and attack the strike group. So they're practicing how to defend. So this is about to happen when these objects that were at 80,000 plus feet suddenly drop down towards the ocean floor in less than a second. And the problem now is that they're in the same airspace as this practice that's about to take place. So it's now a safety issue. So the captain of the cruiser authorizes two of the F-18s from the Nimitz aircraft carrier to go investigate the nearest of these objects. And the nearest one was 50 miles away. So the two F-18s go to the location that the cruiser's radar system tells them where this object is at. So they're flying to a target detected on radar by the cruiser. When they get 60 to 70 miles out, they see the target. They're looking around. They finally see the target. It's below them. They're at 20,000 feet. And the target's near the ocean surface. And the commander of that squadron, who was a Navy graduate with thousands of hours of air experience, the commander of the squadron, he describes this object is jumping around like a ping pong ball, just bouncing off of things. So that this object's in midair and it's just like bouncing around. And the squadron commander decides he's going to fly down and check this thing out, right? As he says, he's going to engage it, not with weapons, but just engage it with his aircraft. So he heads down, and as he heads down, the object tilts towards him and begins moving towards his jet. So that, in a way, that's a form of communication already, because it's indicating that it recognizes his jet. So as he's moving down, it's moving up, and they're doing a little pirouette of circles as they move towards each other. The commander decides he's going to just do a quick diagonal interception as it's moving up and he's moving down. And as soon as he makes that attempt to intercept, the object tilts again. And in 1 to 2 seconds, the object takes off and is gone at extreme rate of speed. This was seen not only by the commander who was engaging the object, but a second jet, which was remaining at 20,000 feet. Right now, here comes the part of a type of communication again. So the object's gone. The two F-18s head back to the USS Nimitz to land, right? Because the object has departed. So they're talking to the USS Princeton, the cruiser, which sent them there in the first place. And then they tell the cruiser, you know, the object's gone. We don't know where it went. We're headed back. The cruiser says, well, you won't believe this, but the object is back at your cap point. Okay, so what's a cap point is actually a secret location that the F-18s fly around in while they defend a carrier strike group. So that's what's called the cap point. So what this location is not known to anyone other than the pilots who are doing, you know, their exercise. Yet the object, which rapidly disappeared and flew away, it flew to their cap point, and it got there within seconds. It would take the jets many, many minutes to get back to the cap point. So this is a case where it almost seems like the object is saying, okay, I know where you're supposed to be at, and to prove to you I know where you are supposed to be, and even though this is a secret location, I will fly to that location and sit there. And that's what the radar operators detected. So that appears to be almost like a form of communication as to what they're trying to say. Who knows?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Was that what are they doing? You know, we can only guess, can't we? They seem to be trying to say, look, we're a lot more superior to you in moving around, but at the same time, they're not doing anything really aggressive.
Right, right. And that's one thing that you mentioned is that they are not aggressive. And throughout history, as far as we know, there have been no indications that they're aggressive. And we have fired on UFOs multiple times, and yet they have not, you know, responded in kind, which is good. But in a way, it makes you think, is this more like there was a historical case where I think a helicopter, it may have been in Brazil, found an isolated Aborigine tribe that had never made contact with humans, other humans before. And they saw this helicopter and they were throwing spears and shooting arrows at it. And of course the guys in the helicopter did not, you know, respond or anything. They just watched what was going on. It almost makes you wonder if it's not the reverse situation where, you know, we're considered so primitive. It's just as if it's an interesting observation for them to watch what we do.
And also the way the craft moved reminded me of a point in your book where you talk about reports that are so strange that there's an odd truth to them.
Right. That's J. Allen Hynek, who was a professor from Northwestern University. He originally was the U.S. Air Force's debunker for all of their UFO reports in Project Blue Book. This is back in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And he later became a believer in UFOs after seeing enough cases. But one of the things he noted was that there was a certain strangeness about some of the reports. And what J. Allen Hynek liked about that was it tells you it's not a hoax or made up when it's that strange. In other words, if someone's going to make up a story, why would they make up a story that is so strange that no one is going to believe it? And that's what some of these reports have, is some features that are so strange, no one believes it. And like one example that I gave in the book, and there's actually many examples of these, the one that comes to my mind is one where a gentleman is driving on Highway 1 in Canada, which is a long east-west route that goes all through Canada. And he goes around a curve, and all of a sudden, here is this disc-shaped object, and his headlights, because it was at night, the beams of his car lights like turn to the right as if the beams of light are being attracted to the disc-shaped object, which is really strange, right? Light does not get attracted to, it's not like a magnet, right? In metal where you can pull it towards something, yet the light was being bent towards the object. That's just, you know, one of many examples of strange things, or sometimes some people have reported the light coming from the UFO was very distinct in column, you know, in a column type of the light. The light was not diffusing and spreading out. It was staying in a column. And as it comes down towards the ground, then all of a sudden the light stops. It doesn't go all the way to the ground. It just, as if you had a, for example, the only thing we could do like that was if you just had a long piece of wood that you were just slowly dropping out from your, you know, your airplane, and then you stop it and it doesn't touch the ground. It's like that. It's almost like the light is drops down and then it stops. And as to how that could be done, you know, I have no idea.
Don't you mention in the book about how sometimes the lights can be very bright, but they just don't light up the area?
Right. Yeah, that's another unusual feature where it's the light is so bright that they can't even look at it, yet the ground around the object is not being lit up. That's one of those strange type of reports that happens a lot with UFOs. And so I give several of those cases in the book and examples of where those, you know, of when and where that happens. I think one of the other strange things about UFOs is just the large amount of differences in shapes, right? I mean, you have on the disc shape, you've got objects that have little domes on them. You have reports of disc-shaped objects that are more oval in appearance or almost like a rugby ball. And then you have more elongated discs that are very long and much larger. And then you've got the triangle, right? And some of them come in an isosceles triangle form, so they're long and pointed. And then you have some that are equilateral triangles. Every side is the same length. That's like in the Belgium wave of 1989 and 1990. Those were equilateral type triangular objects that they saw. And the unique thing about these equilateral triangles is they're almost always the same in appearance. There's usually a large light at each vertice of the triangle, and usually a smaller one in the very center. And then you have all sorts of odd shapes besides, you know, your two basic shapes, which are the discs and the triangles. There are, you know, the reports of cigar-shaped objects, and this one always amazes me, a barbell-shaped object. Like, who would report that they saw a barbell-shaped object floating in the sky, because that's not an aerodynamic shape that you would expect to see. And then, of course, there's cones, and teardrops, rectangles. I mean, any kind of shape you can think of, it has been reported. So it almost makes me wonder if we aren't dealing with more than one origin for many of these UFOs, so that it may be multiple origins. And so think about that for a moment, because, you know, we talk about life in the universe. And if, to me, if there's one intelligent life source out there somewhere, then there are many. I think either we are the only one, right? Or there's just multitudes. I doubt that it's anything in between. And when you see all these different shapes, it makes you wonder if these aren't like multiple civilizations of different origins that just seem to be passing by almost.
And I suppose there's a scientific question there is the travel between stars, because you talk about this in the book, that it may be, as far as we know, you can't travel faster than the speed of light. So how are they traveling between the stars? What do you make of that question?
Right. So to give your listeners a perspective on this, 30 years ago, no scientist would even thought that it made sense to even talk about traveling between the stars. Today, that is different. There's actually a project today. It's called, I believe it's called Project Breakthrough. It was funded by the guy who heads up Facebook is one of the guys funding it. And the basic concept is to send a very small spacecraft, and by very small, I mean one that weighs in grams, to send a small spacecraft to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, at 20% of the speed of light. Now, Alpha Centauri is 4 light years away. So it takes light 4 years to get to Alpha Centauri. So if you have a small craft that can travel at 20% of the speed of light, then it could get to Alpha Centauri in 20 years. So the way they will do this is they reduce the mass of the craft to just a few grams, right, to make the spacecraft as small as possible. They connect it to a giant sail, and then they hit the sails with powerful laser beams. So as the laser beam hits the sail, it's imparting its speed to the sail, just like when the wind blows on a sail, and if the wind's at 20 miles an hour, it's imparting 20 miles an hour of push to the boat's sail. Well, in this case, the light beams are imparting the speed of light into the sail. But the problem, of course, is that light can't push any large mass very rapidly. But if you have powerful enough light beams, like laser beams, you can push something that only weighs a few grams. And in this project that they've designed, in, I believe, approximately 11 minutes, they will have pushed the small spacecraft to 20% of the speed of light, and it will head to Alpha Centauri. And of course, it can't stop. It just keeps going, and it passes by, takes photographs, and then it's gone. But the point I'm trying to bring up here is that the concept of interstellar travel is not as crazy as it seemed 30 years ago, right? And who knows where we will may be in another 30 years. But to get back to your question, Simon, of so how does someone else, though, travel in a large craft, you know, to here? Well, for starters, they'll need a lot of energy in order to accelerate that spacecraft to near the speed of light. So let's say if they were on Alpha Centauri and if they could accelerate their spacecraft to near the speed of light, they would be here in basically 4 of our years, right? Which is a fairly reasonable period of time. A solar system 10 light years away, it would take them 10 years to get here. But a solar system, you know, halfway across the galaxy, which is 20,000 light years away, it would take them 20,000 years to get here near at the speed of light. But with Einstein's theories of relativity, there's a unique thing that happens when you're traveling near the speed of light. For the occupants within the spacecraft, time begins to slow down and actually comes to a stop when you reach the speed of light. So let's take that example of Alpha Centauri again. To us, it takes 4 years for that craft to leave there and get here. The same thing for the people that live on Alpha Centauri. 4 years later, that spacecraft gets to Earth. But for the people inside the spacecraft, time has stopped. So for them, depending on how close to the speed of light they are, It might seem like a week went by. It might seem like a day. It might seem just like a minute went by before they made it to Earth. Do you follow what I'm saying there?
Yeah, it's relative, isn't it? That's the theory of relativity?
Yes, it's that paradox where if you take two twins and one twin stays on Earth, the other twin travels at the speed of light and comes back. And the twin that left, when he comes back, he looks the same. He has not aged. Meanwhile, his twin brother is 40 years older if he had traveled, 40 light years. But what that means, of course, is that whoever is in the spacecraft, when they come back, they come back to a world that's totally different than the world they left, right? So that means to do this, you almost need a civilization that's nomadic, right? Because if you leave on that spaceship to go visit other worlds, you're never coming back to your relatives, right, or your loved ones, because time for them will continue to march by while you're out exploring the galaxy. So it would be a different type of way to look at things if you were willing to travel near the speed of light. Now, that is one way to do it, right? There are also papers that have been written on how you could create wormholes that would allow you to basically pinch through space and suddenly you're in another part of the galaxy through a wormhole. There's arguments as to whether or not that's possible, but there have been papers that have been written, scientific papers that say it can be done, but it requires an enormous amount of energy, much more than we are capable of producing. And then you have the engineering feat of trying to do that, right? So it's more of a theoretical concept than it's anything we could do. But another civilization somewhere else that's more advanced than us, that has the ability to create extreme amounts of energy, might be capable of doing that. And if they were capable of doing it, then they could travel, they could be 1,000 light years away, and suddenly you're here within the blink of an eye. So it's a possible science, but one that for us is hundreds, if not thousands, of years in the future.
And there are people who put forward this argument to say there's no way UFOs could be real because of the time it takes to travel between stars. But almost in a way, you could say, well, that argument's redundant now because UFOs are here. Something is happening. Would you say that?
Yes, I mean, and I say in the book that there is what I consider sufficient scientific evidence to indicate that whatever UFOs are, they are controlled by an intelligence that's far in advance of us. And the argument I make as to why I believe that is true is the acceleration that these objects possess. And I give several examples where there is evidence that supports that these objects are capable of accelerating at enormous speeds in a very short period of time. For example, the USS Princeton and USS Nimitz case that I talked about a little bit earlier, there were three times during that four-hour event where extreme acceleration was noted. One was by the radar operators, right? When they say the object moves tens of thousands of feet in less than a second. That is that type of acceleration actually is in thousands of G-forces. The other incident was, remember when we had two jets, one jet was engaging this object and the other jet remained at 20,000 feet. And when the object began to accelerate away, it disappeared from view in 1 to 2 seconds. Okay, if an object disappears from view in 1 to 2 seconds, you can actually calculate based on the apparent size of the object, how far it has to travel to disappear from human eyesight. So you can actually calculate the amount of acceleration and G-forces generated by an object that disappears from view in 2 seconds. So let me give you something to compare that against. If you go to a military air show and you see a jet fly by, right, and then disappear in the distance, if you count how long it takes that jet to disappear, it's going to be 12 to 13 seconds. And that was with the jet already at speed when he flew by you. If that jet is standing still and has to take off from the runway and then disappear from your eyesight, now you're looking at 25 to 30 seconds for that jet to disappear from sight. So for an object to disappear from sight, from basically standing still to gone in 2 seconds, that you can do the math and you will see that the acceleration is horrendous. So the only issue left for someone is, do you believe the object disappeared in 2 seconds?
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, Simon. I enjoyed the conversation.
The book's called UFOs, A Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know. And people can get that on Amazon and other places?
Yes, they can get it on Amazon.com, also Barnes & Noble, and also directly from the publisher, Roland and Littlefield.
Great. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
All right. Thank you, Simon.
And that was an interview with Robert Powell about his book, UFOs, A Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know. And a great way to support this podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you will get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Our Paranormal Afterlife. There are over 300 episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the links are in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review. And be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. A farmer, I think it was Bloomfield, and he saw a disc that was landed, and he saw it, but when he took 2 steps back, the disc disappeared like it was invisible.
Right, yeah. There's a lot of that, I call it in the book, physics on the edge. That it-